From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last week, Congress reauthorized for another year three key surveillance provisions of the Patriot Act set to expire. Also last week, we spoke with Shane Harris, author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State, who noted that the laws that governed data collection prior to the Patriot Act were a response to Johnson and Nixon-era abuses when government spied on war protesters.
But these were laws that were written in a time when there were comparatively few ways to actually gather data. Tapping a phone, using a satellite.
In the digital age, he says, we're drowning in unconnected data dots, and our focus should be on connecting them.
So I concluded that we need to have our laws focus not so much on the collection and the acquisition of data, but on setting rules and procedures for what the government actually does with those databases.
Harris told us this week that the three newly extended provisions of the Patriot Act will contribute to a flood of dots, but will do little to connect them.
One is the lone wolf terrorist provision. This allows the government to basically start monitoring someone who is not known to be an agent of a foreign power or a member of a terrorist organization. The records provision allows them to go on continuing to collect business records, financial records, potentially library records. And then the third provision is for what's called roving wiretaps, which allows the government to monitor an individual regardless of whether he's using a cell phone or switching between cell phones. They can follow him from one phone to the next.
Was there any attempt in the reauthorization to rein in or adjust any of these provisions?
There was. There was a proposal to get rid entirely of the lone wolf provision. The government has actually stipulated that they've never actually used that particular tool, but the Obama administration wanted to reserve the option. And then for the other two key provisions, for roving wiretaps and for some of the record searches, some members of Congress wanted to insert a stipulation that these could only be used in connection with terrorism investigations and foreign espionage cases. But those restrictions also failed. Frankly, I think the mood in Congress is not really high right now for trying to restrict these tools.
There's a popular media perception that Democrats don't stand up against the Patriot Act because they want to appear tough on terrorism, especially in an election year.
I think there are certainly some Democrats who would prefer not to have this fight. But frankly, I think that's also a very sort of convenient explanation. There are probably a lot more Democrats than would like to admit it that actually favor having these tools in place and having the law stay the way it is. I mean, people often talk about how after 9/11, the Patriot Act was very hastily passed. And while it was passed very quickly, a lot of the provisions that were in there were actually the result of some Democratic senators and changes to surveillance law that they had been trying to make for a long time, and it passed with nearly unanimous support.
But Shane, it also passed largely unread by many members of the Congress. A lot of people didn't know what they were voting for.
That's true. A lot of people didn't know what they were voting for. However, a lot of the key senators and members of Congress who were responsible for crafting that bill gave assurances to their colleagues that what was in that bill was necessary. I think the question is whether or not, when push comes to shove, Democrats or Republicans are willing to stand up and say, yes, it's time to dial these things down. But again, you don't see many members of Congress really willing to get behind that right now. And I think probably it's because a lot of them think maybe it's working or I don't want to be the one to shut it off.
Do you think it's working?
No. I think, you know, I'm not very, you know, optimistic about the collection of information being the solution to all these problems. And it's not at all clear to me that the FBI has been judicious in their use of some of these powers. I mean, we know, for instance, that in the case of national security letters, which are these orders that allow them to gather up all kinds of records and information, that power has been abused. It's been very clumsily applied, maybe inappropriately applied in some cases. But there are some things, for instance, like the roving wiretap provision. I mean, that is one that seems to me to make total sense. In this day and age, when it is just given that a terrorist or a spy or even a common criminal is going to do whatever he can to cover his tracks, dispose of cell phones, use multiple email accounts, you've got to have a way for the government to be able to follow him.
What kind of effect do you think the reauthorization will have on journalists and on regular people?
Will it continue to make some people more cautious in their communications? I think so. Will it increase the suspicion that the government is interested in getting access to library records and to business records? Yes, it will. Particularly, I think it's going to upset a lot of people who wanted to see or who have been waiting to see Democrats in particular kind of stand up on some of these issues. This is just a reminder that you know, the surveillance state is sort of becoming increasingly just a solid reality.
Do you see this as a distraction from the larger problem, in your view, of putting mechanisms in place that will enable us to connect the dots?
It is distracting and taking a lot of energy away from this other question of how do you put the systems in place to connect the dots. When I talk about this over-focus on legislating the collection part, that's what Patriot Act really kind of embodies, is this arguing over, well, can you have access to that record or this record? And what about the lone wolf? And not that those are unimportant questions, but there's only so much sort of space in the legislative window to talk about these issues. And if it's being consumed with all of this part of the discussion, it leaves very little time for the issues of what do you actually do with this stuff when you get it?
So if the president doesn't really want to stand up against it, and if the Democrats don't really want to stand up against it, then I guess the only people who are left standing are the librarians.
And they are a hardy bunch, too.
Shane, thank you very much.
It's my pleasure.
Shane Harris is a reporter for the National Journal and author of The Watchers, The Rise of America's Surveillance State.
The cell phone that you're carrying right now is also a tracking device. As you move from place to place, your phone communicates with cell towers, allowing companies like AT&T and Verizon to locate you often within a few hundred feet. Those coordinates get stored for a time, and while your phone company may not care where you were on some specific night last month, your government might. Law enforcement officials routinely access cell phone records of, say, suspected criminals, often without probable cause. All they need is a judge willing to sign a warrant. But a couple of years ago, a U.S. magistrate in Pennsylvania took a stand and refused the Justice Department access to phone records in a federal drug case because investigators could not show probable cause. Just a few weeks ago, the Justice Department challenged that decision before the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. Kevin Bankston is a senior staff attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which argued against the Justice Department. He says the justice was trying to bolster its case with a couple of Supreme Court precedents from the 1970s.
First, one called Smith v. Maryland, which dealt with government surveillance of the numbers that you dial on the phone and who dials you. And the Supreme Court held that because you directly conveyed that information to the phone company, that you assumed the risk that they would hand it over to the government. This decision followed a similar precedent where the Supreme Court held that you don't have any expectation of privacy in the records that the bank has about your transactions. Because again, you directly conveyed that information to the bank and you assume the risk they'd hand it over to someone else. The government's argument, as absurd and dangerous as it sounds, is that when the 277 million cell phone users in this country bought their phones, they were knowingly and voluntarily trading their location privacy for the right to avail themselves of a modern necessity, the cell phone.
Kevin, permit me to play devil's advocate here. The police have always had to require a court order to put a wiretap in place, for example. But they have never needed one to, you know, follow you around, to put you under surveillance, to stake you out. In what way is ascertaining your location via cell phone records different from doing it with two cops in an unmarked car drinking coffee and eating donuts?
To say that this is akin to just cops tailing a suspect is to ignore the power of this surveillance technique to follow people into even spaces that the police could not follow them into, be it their home or a business. There's a limit to what two cops in a car can do. There's no limit to how this technology could be used to track citizens.
Okay, that's with donuts, but what about with chili dogs?
Chili dogs might speed them up a bit.
Now that so many Americans have GPS installed in their cell phones, it would seem to me that the government has access to even more granular data about not only where you were, but where you are right now.
Absolutely. Every new phone today has a GPS chip. And with that chip, the phone company can locate you down to just a few meters in many cases. At a security and surveillance conference a few months ago, the Sprint electronic surveillance manager admitted that law enforcement was making such extensive use of this capability that Sprint had set up essentially a web portal for law enforcement to go to ping cell phones to find their location based on GPS. He said that that website had been used 8 million times over a one-year period. Basically, through our purchases of cell phones, we American consumers are building the technical infrastructure for a surveillance network that's so extensive and pervasive that even Orwell, or J. Edgar Hoover for that matter, could not have dreamt it up. We're not saying that this information can never be used in a criminal investigation or to, say, you know, locate a kidnapped child or act in another emergency. But we need to make sure that there are appropriate checks and balances so that this capability, which is incredibly powerful, is not abused.
Assuming the Third Circuit upholds the magistrate's decision, based on the trajectory of the Supreme Court over the last number of years, what do you think is apt to happen should the government appeal it there?
Well, I believe the government almost certainly would appeal if it does lose at the appellate level. I can't predict what the Supreme Court would do, but I think it's worth highlighting a rather incisive question that came from one of the judges in the Third Circuit in Philadelphia a couple weeks ago. Judge Sloviter on the panel noted to the government that there are many governments that would be very happy to have this kind of surveillance capability and use it to track political dissidents. She noted Iran as an example. And she asked the government's lawyer, can you represent to me that this is something that the U.S. government would not do and could not do legally? And the government lawyer said, well, I can't speak to hypotheticals, so I can't say we wouldn't do it. And yes, I think that would be constitutional. And so I think that highlights the potential for abuse, the potential for political abuse posed by this technology. So if this does go to the Supreme Court, we will vigorously argue it, and we are hopeful of a good result.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
Kevin Bankston is Senior Staff Attorney for the Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Coming up, Afghanistan muzzles its media and the legal ramifications of flipping the bird.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. On Monday, journalists in Kabul were informed by the Ministry of Justice that they would be operating under a new rule: no more live coverage of terrorist attacks. In fact, reporters aren't even supposed to go near the scene of an attack. This new policy comes amid increasing violence in Kabul, such as last Friday's suicide bombing in the heart of the city.
Taliban fighters attacked central Kabul shortly after dawn this morning.
A squad Taliban bombers struck two guest houses, the intent to kill as many foreigners as possible.
Another blast, civilians flee to safety.
The stated reasons for the ban: live coverage could expose police movements, could jeopardize security, and could embolden attackers by allowing them to bask in the media spotlight. Also, the ban protects journalists by keeping them safe from stray gunshots or shrapnel. But so far, the decision has been met with resounding criticism from journalists and free press advocates. Saad Mosseini heads the Mobi Media Group, which runs one of Afghanistan's most popular TV stations, Tolo TV. Mosseini says that in recent days, even some in the government have distanced themselves from the coverage ban, saying it was the unsanctioned work of a few individuals in the security forces and not an official decree. Meanwhile, journalists continue to work in the midst of the confusion. As Mosseini explains, the new rules are both vague and all-encompassing.
This applies not just to Afghan media, but it applies to international media as well, such as CNN, and NPR, and Reuters, and AP.
Let me see if I understand this. If there is a bombing, for example, then there is, of course, an aftermath. If ABC or CBS or your cameras show up and report live from the aftermath of an incident, they will be subject to having their cameras confiscated and to being jailed?
According to this letter, yes. And according to the verbal warnings that our journalists have received, that's correct. When they say a terrorist act, they don't actually specify what that entails. As far as the government is concerned, it could last 24 hours. So we have to seek the approval of the intelligence agency before filming, even after the incident was over. And if we decided to film without their permission, that our person be locked up and equipment confiscated.
The pretext for this ruling was to protect security forces. Do you think that was what the government had in mind?
No, I think it's just that they don't want to be seen as a bunch of novices or amateurs. We are Afghans. We care about the security of this nation. Of course, we're not going to give away operational secrets. You have to understand that in the past, coverage of these types of incidents have exposed the security forces' vulnerabilities and their weaknesses and their lack of professionalism. And I think that that's what concerns the government. For example, when we had a situation a few weeks back, when we had a major avalanche in the north of Afghanistan, there were reports, and we did, of course, cover these, of police officers emptying the pockets of dead victims or officials neglecting half-dead individuals, assuming that they were dead. They'd just been frozen. So, of course, this concerns the government. But as a media organization, we have to cover these sorts of things. How could we not?
It's fair to assume that coverage of bombings does a kind of propaganda favor for the Taliban. Do you think the government just doesn't want to give the enemy the opportunity to parade its successes on live TV?
When 9/11 happened, would you have expected CNN to stop its transmissions of the Twin Towers getting hit? The situation is no different. The public demands to know what's going on. And you have to understand also that in a city the size of Kabul, you can't avoid hearing the explosions and the gunfire. The public doesn't want to watch this because they're bored. They want to watch what's going on because they need to know. They have kids at school. They have partners at work. People get very, very stressed, not knowing. The government could use this medium to reassure the public. It can cordon off the area to ensure that the media doesn't get too close, but it cannot ban the media. You cannot kill the messenger.
I'm wondering, based on the message and the warnings that you got, have you changed your coverage at all?
No, of course not. I mean, I think at the end of the day, we will do what's right for the Afghan public. It's difficult for all media organizations and for journalists to abide by the wishes of the government. This goes even in the U.S. But I think that now we're starting to see some common sense prevail. And discussions we've had with senior government officials, including the Minister for Information and Culture, indicates that the president wishes for this issue to be resolved amicably. And it seems to us also that the president probably never endorsed this ban. This ban was probably the working of one or two individuals within the security apparatus. But at the same time, we cannot accept such a ban.
Do you think the Afghan government is concerned about only the Afghan audience, or are they concerned about images reaching the rest of the world?
Well, I mean, you have to understand that the Afghan state is a heavily subsidized state. And, of course, viewers in the U.S. and the U.K. as well as Europe can ultimately determine how much assistance Afghanistan gets and so forth. And, of course, they don't want to be seen as weak, inept, disorganized, and corrupt. And I think that's why it's very important for them also to have some sort of a say as far as what goes out to the outside world.
Saad, thank you very much.
Thank you, my friend.
Saad Mohseini is director of the Mobi Media Group. He joined us from Kabul.
For the past few years, politicians like George Allen and celebrities like Michael Richards have seen their careers crater when videos of their offensive behavior went viral on the net. Of course, ordinary people are obnoxious too, but they have a degree of anonymity that can shield them from the consequences. In China, however, being an ordinary Joe cannot protect you because of a phenomenon known as the human flesh search engine. It's not really a search engine, but rather a population of internet message board users that, if sufficiently outraged, will do whatever it takes to track the offending person down in the real world and ruin his or her life. Tom Downey writes about the human flesh search engine in this weekend's New York Times Magazine, and he says that the term first referred to harmless searches conducted by humans, Chinese web users who would submit questions to the message boards, and real people, not algorithms, would come up with the answers. But now he says the term denotes a search for people, after a perverse video was circulated of a woman casually using her stiletto heels to stomp a kitten to death.
When Chinese internet users saw this video, they were outraged. After people started to talk about this all over the internet, eventually people from the actual town where this woman lived, saw the video and were able to say, she's a nurse at the hospital where I live. And eventually she was identified.
And fired.
And that was the kind of job that people normally keep for life in China. It's what the Chinese call an iron rice bowl.
So her life was ruined.
Yeah. Her kids felt terrible going to school every day because other students were making fun of them. And eventually she just had to leave town, along with the cameraman, who was also a resident of the same town, who filmed her.
She stomped a kitten to death.
For sure. This is something terrible. It's animal cruelty. These human flesh search engines usually start out because there's something that people are legitimately outraged about. And, you know, one of the other points about this is there's not really any legal framework to prosecute people for animal cruelty in China. So whereas here, you find somebody who's torturing a kitten or killing a kitten, you could report them to the authorities and the person could be prosecuted. That's not going to happen in China.
The second big case that you cite in your piece, a man cheats on his wife who kills herself because of it, and then her tragic diary is posted online, generating a great deal of anger. That seemed to be a clear example of how the role of the human search engine changes from justice-seeking to revenge.
Yeah. In that case, there wasn't much searching that actually went on. People assembled very early on his name, his employment ID, where he went to school, his license plate number. I mean, every possible detail you could imagine about this person. People were going to his family's apartment, painting in red Chinese characters, humiliating him. This guy became afraid of going out in public because his face was so well known. I mean, it was plastered all over not just the internet, but the Chinese media.
Is there something about the structure of Chinese society that has given rise to this search for justice by ordinary people online?
Yeah. The absence of a real strong rule of law and the absence of institutional means to redress corruption are really some of the big factors behind why people go to human flesh search. One of the cases that I talk about in the piece is a case where a government official is accused of trying to molest a young girl. Imagine that happens in the United States. You go to the police. They arrest the guy. While there are some inroads being made to address those kinds of corruption in China, there's not a generally accepted institutional means to redress corruption and bad behavior by government officials. Therefore, people resort to things like the human flesh search.
And as you note in your piece, the Chinese government doesn't mind it very much.
I think that's right. One of the reasons that we see human flesh searches against provincial or local level officials not being cracked down upon is because the central government actually doesn't want corruption on the local level in many cases. They have an interest in this watchdog effect. If they allow rampant corruption, then the central government's authority is undermined.
But the problem is if a human flesh search engine moves into a vacuum that is left by a rule of law that does not work, you have chaos. My colleague Bob Garfield has written a book called The Chaos Scenario, and he raised this issue in a very neat phrase. He says that perhaps we have less to fear from Big Brother than we do from Lord of the Flies. People who aren't guilty can be tracked down with the same vehemence and brutality as people who are.
Yeah. In a lot of these cases, the actual justice of the outcome is very ambiguous. Even in the case where the government official is accused of trying to molest the young girl, I went to that restaurant. I spoke to the waiters and waitresses and floor directors, and it really wasn't clear that the guy was trying to molest this little girl. It was clear that he acted in an extremely arrogant and dismissive way when her parents confronted him, and that was terrible in its own right. But the original thing that really sparked the incident, it's pretty unclear.
And I think for me, the most sobering part of the story is that dissenters were being targeted by patriotic Chinese for disagreeing with the policies of the government.
I think that any situation like this, where basically there's a kind of mob mentality, creates difficulty for people who have minority viewpoints. In China, there's a specific phenomenon called angry youth. This is one of the groups that the government often is able to use to quash the viewpoints of dissenters.
You suggest in your piece that this mass vigilantism pacifies the masses and keeps them from protesting the wider political injustice and corruption in China.
Instead of people thinking about, for example, is the central government corrupt? When we see human flesh searches that focus anger on a very specific and typically low-level figure, it's a way of diffusing that anger, and it's a way of focusing it on somebody who's a pretty easy scapegoat.
Tom Downey is the author of The Last Men Out, about a rescue firehouse in Brooklyn. His piece on the human flesh search engine in China appears in this weekend's New York Times Magazine. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Wired magazine reported this week about an unusual legal case now underway in Oregon. A 46-year-old retiree named Robert Ikas is suing his local police department because he says they've repeatedly cited him for bogus moving violations. Ikas says that the real reason the cops keep pulling him over isn't his driving. It's because he keeps giving them the finger. Professor Ira Robbins is the author of the article Digitus Impudicus, The Middle Finger and the Law. He says that generally American courts protect the flipping of the bird. When people do end up in court for giving the one-fingered salute, they're usually let go.
Almost always, the case is dismissed, or if there's a conviction, it's reversed on appeal.
So just to be clear, Americans do have the right to flip off their local police officers.
It seems to me there is a constitutional right under the First Amendment to flip off police officers. I'm not saying it's wise to do it. I'm not going to give the finger to a police officer, but I'm saying that it's constitutionally protected.
That is your opinion, but it is not yet a settled matter.
Well, it's not a settled matter as a national question. But in some jurisdictions, it is a settled matter. In Pennsylvania, for example, courts time and again have said that just flipping off the bird with no other criminal behavior attached is constitutionally protected. And last year, a man who was arrested and prosecuted for this sued the police department and ended up getting a $50,000 settlement.
Now, in your article, you talk about the history of this gesture, and you write that while some of the origin stories are probably apocryphal, the Digitus Impudicus goes back at least to ancient Rome.
It really does. It goes back at least 2,500 years or so. The Digitus Impudicus, meaning the impudent finger, goes back to Emperor Caligula, who extended his middle finger, and that is recorded. Augustus Caesar once banished an actor from Italy, from the whole country, for giving the finger to an audience member who had hissed him during a performance. To the best of my recollection and research, though, the first recorded instance of the Digitus Impudicus in the United States was in 1886, when there was a professional baseball team photograph with two teams in the same picture: the Boston Bean Eaters and the New York Giants. Even then, New York and Boston had a great baseball rivalry, but some of the baseball players were giving the finger in the photo just as some sort of implicit protest.
Obviously, you see this, actually I see this too, as a free speech issue. But one of the few limitations on speech that we have in this country is a restriction on obscenity. Could the middle finger legally be considered an obscene gesture and therefore fall under those restrictions?
I think we generally have a right to free speech and free expression. There are some exceptions to that. For example, if a gesture or use of certain words are fighting words, or something is obscene, or something is profane under a test that was developed approximately 30 years ago, then it would not be protected. I would argue that this is not obscene, that this is not fighting words, this is not profane. Why do people generally use the middle finger now? It seems to me to express anger, rage, maybe in a road rage situation, defiance, protest. The Robert Ikas case in Oregon involves somebody who basically believes he has the right to protest police abuse, and he does that simply by using the middle finger gesture.
Now, no one knows for sure how the Supreme Court would decide this case, but one advocate might be Justice Antonin Scalia, because when the New York Times asked him for his response to the people who objected to his participating in weekly mass, his reported response was the Sicilian equivalent of the middle finger.
Well, I think that's right, but I don't think that's an indication that Justice Scalia will necessarily come out in a way that's supportive of using that gesture.
But he's a finger giver.
Well, he gave the equivalent of the finger, but just this month, or last week rather, Senator Jim Bunning gave the finger to some journalist. Why wasn't he arrested and prosecuted for disorderly conduct? Is it okay to have the Bunning salute, but not the one-fingered salute or flipping the bird?
Now, you've mentioned that you don't think it's wise to flip the bird at the cops, but are you yourself a bird flipper?
Well, only on the radio. How's that?
What an evasion.
Well, seriously, normal people, I like to see myself as a normal person, sometimes get upset, sometimes get frustrated, sometimes get angry. It's not intended to be obscene or profane or to incite anyone to do anything. It's just an expression that I say is protected by the First Amendment.
Would you love this case to go to the Supreme Court, or would you fear?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, we had a flag-burning case more than 20 years ago. The question was whether flag-burning is protected under the First Amendment as freedom of expression. And the ruling was that it was protected, but only by a vote of 5-4. This is a very different Supreme Court. I'm not sure which way this would go. Yes, I'd like to have a ruling, but I'd like to have a ruling that says the right thing, the thing that makes the most sense, and I'm not sure we would get that from the Supreme Court.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Ira Robbins is a professor of law and justice at American University.
Coming up, why a computer-generated face that's too close to perfection can sink a film.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from LendingTree, committed to helping people control their financial destiny with innovative tools and personalized advice at LendingTree.com. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people online at WTGrantFoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
My sister, my brother, everybody in the family, you just murdered them. Who murdered them? That son of a bitch on the stairway!
That's from a film called Iron Cross, which was released this week to very little fanfare. It actually had a limited run in L.A. late last year to generate critical buzz, but most critics were unenthusiastic. Variety, Hollywood's trade magazine, on the other hand, was quite impressed. Editor Tim Gray wrote a piece last summer in which he listed Iron Cross, among about 50 other films, as a potential Oscar nominee. Gawker's investigation editor John Cook says that Gray's article was the first step in a dust-up that raises questions about the relationship between Tinseltown and the press that covers it. The saga starts on the day Gray's column ran.
And on that very day, a salesperson for Variety called up Joshua Newton, the director of Iron Cross, and said, hey, did you see that you're on our list of Oscar contenders, and sold them on a $400,000 Oscar campaign.
Now, I should say in fairness that it would be one thing for the sales department to do that on its own initiative, and another thing altogether for the column to have been written in order to give the sales department ad selling opportunities. Do you have any insight on this?
Well, I certainly don't have any insight into what Timothy Gray was thinking when he wrote that column. I haven't heard back from him. But, you know, I do know that Oscar campaigns, for your consideration advertising, make up a huge amount of the ad budget of Variety. I think in 2004, it was something like 80% of their advertising was purchased during the 3 months that precede the balloting for nominees and then the 3 months that precede the actual balloting for the winners.
Well, let's just assume for the moment that the column was not intended to prime the pump for the sales department. Nonetheless, Joshua Newton, having been contacted and having seen his film floated as an Oscar contender, said, yeah, you know, I think I do need a four-year consideration campaign, and proceeded to spend $400,000 in Variety, correct?
Correct. Ads for the film ran every day in Daily Variety for, I think, the entire month of November leading up to the balloting for the nominees. And then on top of that, they were also placed in Variety's screening series. Variety hosts screenings in New York, San Francisco, and L.A. that are usually designed for Academy members to be able to come in and see some of these films on the big screen. And a lot of people that I talked to in Hollywood, sort of, there was a question of like, what's this little film doing, you know, next to all of these bigger films? Why is this here?
All right, so the nomination period begins, and next thing you know, in Variety is a review of Iron Cross, and it's terrible. It's a pan, and the director flips out. Why?
The way he put it to me is, these were our promotional partners, And, you know, we engaged in a joint venture with Variety to promote this movie to convince the Academy that it was worthy of an Oscar. And here you have Variety publishing a review that was very critical of this film.
He admitted to you that he was expecting favorable treatment from the editorial side.
Well, he said that editorial considerations never came up in the negotiations, but he did make clear that he felt that he had been mistreated by Variety. He said it was not the decent thing to do, and that this joint venture that they'd engaged upon together meant something to him.
You know, what's particularly funny to me about this is that publishers are all the time talking about their customers as their partners. They're not partners, they're customers.
Right,
but
right.
I guess some customers take this partnership talk a little too seriously. The man is actually threatening to sue.
Yes, he said they're considering their options and that there are very valid issues at stake. It'd be very interesting to know what kind of claims were made to him during the discussions over this $400,000 campaign.
It would indeed, and I should say that Variety offered the opportunity to discuss this with us, declined. But what we do know is that Variety took down the review that had been written by a freelancer off of its site. And although they never spoke to the press about it, there was some email traffic that explained that the review did not meet its editorial standards, and that's why it was pulled. Do you buy that?
Not for a minute, no. I mean, I think the reason they pulled it is because they were facing a very angry partner and or customer. I half suspect what happened was the film actually showed for a week at a theater in L.A. at weird times, just a qualifying run. It wasn't advertised. And one of the things that Joshua Newton was puzzled by is how Robert Kohler even knew to go see this film.
Robert Kohler, the reviewer.
Yeah. And my hope is that the editors and the writers at Variety realized what was going on here, and that there was this promotional push and that it was being included in this film series, and decided to assert their editorial independence and review the film on their own.
You mean to intentionally stick it to the man. Do you have any evidence for that hope?
Newton himself suspects that. And the way he put it to me is he thinks that Kohler must have known about all this, about this joint venture, and that he must have gone and found the film intentionally and reviewed it intentionally. I haven't spoken to Kohler. Neither he nor anyone at Variety has gotten back to me, but that would be my hope.
Well, if he's right, and there was a quid pro quo, a pox on both their houses, no?
Well, I'm kind of sympathetic almost to someone who spends that kind of money under circumstances where they think they're entitled to something. And it certainly seems that what's going on here is that Variety's out there trolling for people that they can sell Oscar campaigns to. And if they're dropping names and their sales staff is calling them up, it's hard to blame someone for getting duped.
So if the cops stake out a street corner and arrest both the streetwalker and the John, your sympathy is with the John?
That's a fair point. That's a fair point.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Bob. Good to be here.
John Cook is the investigations editor for the website Gawker.
Yes, it's Oscar time. Avatar is the great blue whale the smaller films must beat. Among its qualities, the exquisite 3D rendering of the Na'vi, the aliens we come to love. Because they are aliens, filmmaker James Cameron was able to leap over the dangerous chasm into which many computer-driven movies fall, never to recover. It's a fear-inducing phenomenon called the Uncanny Valley. On the Media's Jamie York explains.
In 2001, DreamWorks was paying approximately $60 million for an animated movie about a green ogre named Shrek. And the Animation Brain Trust, tasked with making this $60 million investment pay dividends, was well on their way. Lovable, if grotesque, green ogre? Check. Donkey sidekick that cracks wise? Check. Fantastic world for everyone to inhabit? Check. There was just one problem. In test screenings, the heroine, princess, and motivating force behind the movie was having a most unexpected effect.
They were so good at doing what they were doing with the princess character that when they showed it to audiences of children, the children started crying and freaking out because there was something wrong.
That's Lawrence Weschler, a longtime journalist who wrote about this incident for Wired magazine. It's true, the animators of Shrek were so good, so sophisticated, that they were scaring their intended audience. Why? Their princess had fallen into what's known as the Uncanny Valley.
Which was this notion by a Japanese roboticist named Masahiro Mori, The notion was that if you made a robot that was 50% lifelike, that was fantastic. If you made a robot that was 90% lifelike, that was fantastic. If you made it 95% lifelike, that was the best. That was so great. If you made it 96% lifelike, it was a disaster. And the reason essentially is because a 95% lifelike robot is a robot that's incredibly lifelike. A 96% lifelike robot is a human being with something wrong.
Mori called it the uncanny valley, a play on Sigmund Freud's idea of the uncanny, something familiar and yet foreign at the same time. Science and technology writer Clive Thompson.
More or less around the early 2000s, you started to get computer graphics inside games good enough that the people looked very people-like. And they were hitting that valley point because you would look at them and you go, oh, wow, that looks really realistic. And you get up close and you'd see the face and you'd realize that the skin wasn't quite moving the way it's supposed to move. And the eyes look sort of fish-like. And it was just, ah, you know, I would just shriek and shriek like a little girl because this face looked so horrifyingly dead and dull.
A computer-generated character climbs out of the valley when it finally looks and acts real. Create a character like Homer Simpson, and you're fine. A character like Tomb Raider's Lara Croft is a little unnatural, but so be it. The animated character based on Tom Hanks in The Polar Express, seriously creepy. The makers of Shrek, having learned their lesson, reimagined Princess Fiona as a slightly more cartoony-looking love interest, thus avoiding the valley. But Final Fantasy, a $135 million digital adventure which opened the same year as Shrek, fell into the valley and bombed. The studio that made it later folded. Similarly, Polar Express and Beowulf the movie left audiences unnerved by characters with dead eyes. On the other hand, Avatar...
Looks like you. This is your Avatar.
...uses awe-inspiring technology but avoids the uncanny valley because the aliens are distinctly alien. Blue, stretched, and unreal. The faces of the Na'vi don't trigger our uncanny reflexes because they're simply not human. Faces, despite 10 years of refinement in computer rendering, they're still the holy grail. So many muscles attached to each other, moving in tandem. So many complex and inimitable plays of light.
With faces, and especially with the whites of eyes, light behaves in a quantum fashion, exactly the way it does in milk. So that if you want to create a digital glass of milk and have a digital light go around it, unless you use quantum physics, you're going to end up with something that looks like chalk.
So much so, the animators practice first with bowls of digital milk. Wechsler says that's because just a glimmer of inauthentic light in the eyes is enough to sink a project. Pixar, a company born of digital animation, which featured a rather unintentionally frozen-looking baby in one of its first short films. Pixar learned it wasn't worth the risk. And it's no coincidence that they've built their fortunes making protagonists out of those things that are easiest to light. Shiny toys, cars, bugs, monsters, robots, and old men with square heads who love balloons.
Are you in need of any assistance today, sir?
No.
Well, I gotta help you cross something.
No, I'm doing fine.
What's insurmountable in films is doubly so in video games, where the rendering has to happen on a second-by-second basis. Carmack Dorman is a professor of computer-human interaction at the Indiana University Department of Informatics. Intent on bridging the valley, he's been testing what precisely we feel when we look at near humans on the screen.
Out of perhaps, 28 different emotions, there are about 5 key emotions that are highly predictive of uncanny reaction. And the most important one is fear.
There are a number of theories as to why we fear when we gaze into the uncanny valley. One suggestion is that it's existential, because we see the potential for being replaced by nearly perfect computers. I don't quite buy that. Theologians argue that we're seeing human imitators that lack a soul. For me, the most convincing explanation for the fear is evolutionary. We see an uncanny face as something not quite right. Something unhealthy or unappealing, and our instinct is to recoil. Maybe they're contagious. Maybe they're not suitable mates. Asif Ghazanfar is a professor in the Neuroscience Institute in the psychology department at Princeton University. He'd heard of the dread engendered by the uncanny valley, so he sought to test the reaction with his evolutionary indicator of choice, macaque monkeys.
Of course, we can't test extinct ancestors, so the only way you can test an evolutionary hypothesis in psychology or neuroscience or in any field is to do a comparative study. where you test a closely related species.
Ghazanfar created for his subjects three different kinds of what he calls synthetic monkey faces, one unrealistic, one realistic, and one real. He flashed these faces on a screen for his five monkey subjects to watch in random order for 2 seconds each, and he tracked where their eyes went.
I mean, there's good reasons to think that they increased their looking times to things that they prefer. All five monkeys, as actually really remarkable, all five monkeys showed exactly the same pattern. When they look at the one that we predict would elicit the uncanny valley response, they looked at those images the least amount of time, which is also seems consistent with the interpretation that we're actually seeing a real uncanny valley effect.
Ghazanfar's research seems to suggest that the valley is real and the response is evolutionary, but we still don't know why. Ed Ulbrich knows the uncanny valley as only an explorer could. He was approached in the mid-90s to create the technology for the curious case of Benjamin Button. He concluded that it was impossible, and he declined. But in 2002, he reconsidered, and with his fellow animators, built the most sophisticated human likeness yet to appear on film. In the first 50 minutes of the film, we see a purely digital version of Brad Pitt's face, aging backwards. Ulbrich says that portion of the film plants a flag squarely on the other side of the valley.
To see the first motion of Benjamin now, a digital character, that carried all the subtleties of Brad's performance, it was a giant relief, and it was kind of celebratory. It's like, okay, we've done it. We're here.
But Lawrence Weschler and Clive Thompson argue that Ulbrich didn't scale the deepest part of the valley. Old wrinkled skin reacts to light differently and is easier to digitally render. And the conceit of a human aging backwards is inherently unreal, a fantasy. So we're more likely to forgive the uncanny effect. They're waiting for a romantic comedy where the lead is, oh, by the way, a digital creation.
Do a CGI version of, you know, a well-known star like Gwyneth Paltrow in a way that I cannot tell it's not her and I'm not freaked out by it. When you've got that, you know, I'll accept that you've crossed the valley, but not before then.
Clive Thompson says that when it comes to his beloved video games, he'd rather they give up than subject him to any more freaky zombie-like characters. He believes that if game designers would only ease off the obsession with realism, they could find true art.
Think back to, like, the great age of deep realism in painting. And it sort of reached a point where, like, if you want to do a realistic painting of a road, there are only so many ways for that road to look. Because, frankly, there are only a few ways that roads are different in the real world. Whereas when you get the Impressionists and the Cubists and that reaction, they're saying, there are 1,000 ways we can paint a road or a human face, right? Because we're trying to get at something that is deeper than just what it looks like. And suddenly art, in my view, became much more interesting and much more expressive.
For Lawrence Weschler, really bridging the gap between real and virtual comes down to something more ineffable than the algorithm for Newtonian light refraction or the blush on a cheek. For him, the eyes are important not simply because they're a problem to be solved, but because they have something more to tell us about what crossing the valley would really represent.
Sartre has this beautiful essay called The Face. He writes, "If I watch his eyes, I see that they are not fastened in his head, serene like agate marbles. They are being created at each moment by what they look at." It's a great notion, the notion that what we face when we face a face is the future in some sense. It's omnivorous with intent and with expectation and with desire and with fear in a way that a thigh is not, which is why animating it becomes so much more complicated and so much more exciting.
That future, of course, isn't so far away. Scientist Asif Ghazanfar of Princeton envisions the creation of a digital human face that can help treat autism. Carl McDormand at Indiana University foresees a day when robots are companions for the elderly. And both are sure that time is coming, carried on a technological wave funded by Hollywood. But they are also sure that success will raise even more existential questions. McDormand imagines the moment when an old woman first realizes that her beloved companion is synthetic and doesn't really understand her. That's an uncanny shudder of a different kind, the kind we have when we stare in the face of what it means to be human. For On the Media, I'm Jamie York. Thank you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Folo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Dylan Keefe.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And to our friend John Solomon, get well. We're thinking of you. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.